cut. Lasseter and his Pixar team had the first half of the movie ready to screen by November 1993, so they brought it down to Burbank to show to Katzenberg and other Disney executives. Peter Schneider, the head of feature animation, had never been enamored of Katzenberg's idea of having outsiders make animation for Disney, and he declared it a mess and ordered that production be stopped. Katzenberg agreed. "Why is this so terrible?" he asked a colleague, Tom Schumacher. "Because it's not their movie anymore," Schumacher bluntly replied. He later explained, "They were following Katzenberg's notes, and the project had been driven completely off track." Lasseter realized that Schumacher was right. "I sat there, and I was pretty much embarrassed with what was on the screen," he recalled. "It was a story filled with the most unhappy, mean characters that I've ever seen." He asked Disney for the chance to retreat back to Pixar and rework the script. Katzenberg was supportive. Jobs did not insert himself much into the creative process. Given his proclivity to be in control, especially on matters of taste and design, this self-restraint was a testament to his respect for Lasseter and the other artists at Pixar, as well as for the ability of Lasseter and Catmull to keep him at bay. He did, however, help manage the relationship with Disney, and the Pixar team appreciated that. When Katzenberg and Schneider halted production on Toy Story, Jobs kept the work going with his own personal funding, and he took their side against Katzenberg. "He had Toy Story all messed up," Jobs later said. "He wanted Woody to be a bad guy, and when he shut us down, we kind of kicked him out and said, 'This isn't what we want,' and did it the way we always wanted." The Pixar team came back with a new script 3 months later. The character of Woody morphed from being a tyrannical boss of Andy's other toys to being their wise leader. His jealousy after the arrival of Buzz Lightyear was portrayed more sympathetically, and it was set to the strains of a Randy Newman song, "Strange Things." The scene in which Woody pushed Buzz out of the window was rewritten to make Buzz's fall the result of an accident triggered by a little trick Woody initiated involving a Luxo lamp. Katzenberg and company approved the new approach, and by February 1994, the film was back in production. Katzenberg had been impressed with Jobs' focus on keeping costs under control. Even in the early budgeting process, Steve was very eager to do it as efficiently as possible, he said. But the $17 million production budget was proving inadequate, especially given the major revision that was necessary after Katzenberg had pushed them to make Woody too edgy. So Jobs demanded more in order to complete the film right. "Listen, we made a deal," Katzenberg told him. "We gave you business control, and you agreed to do it for the amount we offered." Jobs was furious. He would call Katzenberg by phone or fly down to visit him and be, in Katzenberg's words, "as wildly relentless as only Steve can be." Jobs insisted that Disney was liable for the cost overruns because Katzenberg had so badly mangled the original concept that it required extra work to restore things. "Wait a minute," Katzenberg shot back. "We were helping you. You got the benefit of our creative help, and now you want us to pay you for that." It was a case of two control freaks arguing about who was doing the other a favor. Ed Catmull, more diplomatic than Jobs, was able to reach a compromise new budget. "I had a much more positive view of Jeffrey than some of the folks working on the film did," he said. But the incident did prompt Jobs to start plotting about how to have more leverage with Disney in the future. He did not like being a mere contractor. He liked being in control. That meant Pixar would have to bring its own funding to projects in the future, and it would need a new deal with Disney. As the film progressed, Jobs became ever more excited about it. He had been talking to various companies ranging from Hallmark to Microsoft about selling Pixar, but watching Woody and Buzz come to life made him realize that he might be on the verge of transforming the movie industry. As scenes from the movie were finished, he watched them repeatedly and had friends come by his home to share his new passion. "I can't tell you the number of versions of Toy Story I saw before it came out," said Larry Ellison. "It eventually became a form of torture. I'd go over there and see the latest 10% improvement." Steve is obsessed with getting it right, both the story and the technology, and isn't satisfied with anything less than perfection. Jobs' sense that his investments in Pixar might actually pay off was reinforced when Disney invited him to attend a gala press preview of scenes from Pocahontas in January 1995 in a tent in Manhattan's Central Park. At the event, Disney CEO Michael Eisner announced that Pocahontas would have its premiere in front of 100,000 people on 80-foot-high screens on the Great Lawn of Central Park. Jobs was a master showman who knew how to stage great premieres, but even he was astounded by this plan. Buzz Lightyear's great exhortation, "To infinity and beyond," suddenly seemed worth heeding. Jobs decided that the release of Toy Story that November would be the occasion to take Pixar public. Even the usually eager investment bankers were dubious and said it couldn't happen. Pixar had spent 5 years hemorrhaging money, but Jobs was determined. "I was nervous and argued that we should wait until after our second movie," Lasseter recalled. "Steve overruled me and said we needed the cash so we could put up half the money for our films and renegotiate the Disney deal."